Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. We are going to discuss the markets a lot in this segment. We're also going to get into a little bit more on the resource sector, but really overall, it seems like we are entering maybe a bit more of a slower period for markets. That being said, boy, oh boy, we have seen some volatility over the last couple weeks on the back of really COVID news and also that Fed meeting. So to kick off this show, we are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago, also founder and editor of the Lyons Share website, which I will post a link to within this weekend show posting on our website. Now, Dana, I always like to start off with the U.S. equity markets with you because you have your internal models that you follow very closely. And you know what? Throughout this year, you've been spot on for these market moves. The last time we chatted a couple weeks ago, about 2 to 3 weeks ago, it was before U.S. Thanksgiving, you had said that your models, for the most part, were lining up in a more bullish sense for the U.S. markets. And then, well, shortly after we chatted, sure enough, we got the whole news on the new COVID variant that threw markets off on that shortened trading day Friday after Thanksgiving. The markets have rebounded quite nicely, but it was, or at least led to, about a week and a half of choppy trading for the markets. Dana, what are your models telling you? Did that quick move down, but then rebound, change anything about your market outlook?
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Didn't really change anything from the intermediate standpoint. Certainly in the short term, it has changed stuff a little bit, which I'll get back to. But as you mentioned, going into Black Friday, from a technical standpoint, the market was certainly set up well for a breakout and a new up leg across most of the averages and sectors. The one fly in the ointment, which I spoke about at the time, was that one of our breadth measures that goes into our risk model that pretty much orients our positioning bullish or bearish had not quite turned positive, and it was because of a downturn in the breadth statistics, some of the breadth readings in the month of November. So that was one major red flag that, you know, we wish we would have heeded 100% because we were, from because of the technical setup, we're gearing up for on the long side for a breakout in a new up leg there. We held off on getting super aggressive because of the our risk model, because of this holdout in the breath and the starting the beginnings of a breakdown in some of the internal measures of the market. And indeed, as invariably happens, our quantitative model was correct and my suspicions were wrong, which is, you know, another one of those valuable investment lessons that they always say price is truth, but I would say price can lie in the near term. You want to listen to some of the breadth measures, the internal measures, I would say are ultimately more truthful at the end of the day. So I would not dismiss those internal measures, even when looking at price measures, and technically everything could be set up. But below the surface, not everything was hunky-dory. And we saw on Black Friday, the rug got pulled out from under investors. And we did take a hit on Friday, but that began one of those, what we call a shock, short-term shock period in the market, where you get that sharp sell-off, you get volatility, and you lead into a initial low. So we did adopt, we were, thanks to our model, we were quick to adopt a lot of hedges last week, looking for that initial spike, initial low, which we got this past Friday, which brought with it some good sentiment readings, some good fear readings, and probably a pretty solid initial low. From there, the typical shock period, you get that initial low, You get a reflexive rebound, which we're in now, before another wave down or a retest or some sort of abbreviated sell-off, which is what we're looking for right now. We have gotten very defensive again in the last couple of days, on guard for another wave down or retest, what have you, before lining up for finally a decent end of the year rally and or rally into the new year, perhaps.
Well, Dana, it sounds like we still could get that Santa Claus rally, but you're waiting for, like you said, another retest. So just speak to investors that maybe see these shock periods as negative, but really you want the sentiment to be cleared. You want that high volatility to show up, and you want some of these indicators to kind of cool off a little bit to make way for a run higher. So could you speak to how it actually, these shock periods actually set up rallies?
Yeah, sure. So I think you have to separate kind of the intermediate term from the short term. So intermediate term, we've seen the deterioration in the internal measures and the breadth measures, which is not a good trend and ultimately might result in, you know, more of a significant downturn. But in the short term, I think sentiment can be your most valuable investment or trading tool when you get these spikes in fear like we saw last Friday. For example, the term structure in the volatility market spiked, put to call ratio spiked to the highest levels since I think the COVID crash. Same thing with trading in inverse ETFs or hedges spiked up. So when you see those spikes in fear, those are very reliable short-term trading tools or trading junctures. So from a longer-term standpoint, we don't want to see this deterioration in the breadth and expansion of new lows continue. But from a short-term perspective, that spike in fear that we saw last Friday, and if we get another retest and another bump up, a little echo bounce in the fear readings, I think that will be enough to put that risk-reward ratio squarely in the hands of the bulls, and should produce, if history is any guide, and typically it is when it comes to sentiment, should put the market on footing for a decent bounce.
So Dana, let's isolate some of the winners and some of the losers in this market, because we're definitely not in that environment where everything is moving higher. That seemed like it was more the beginning of this year, end of the year. Now people are being a bit more selective. Where are you seeing? Let's start with some of the winners, the winning sectors that you like.
Sure, that is one thing that we're seeing, more of a clear delineation between winners and losers, or things setting up to be winners versus losers right now. So you want, in these shock periods, you want to look at things that have held up the best, and certainly in that category at this time would be stuff like technology, the broad technology. There are pockets of weakness certainly in the tech space, like software and internet. But broadly speaking, technology, semiconductors holding up very well. Elsewhere, we're looking at home builders, real estate, REITs holding up very well. Even consumer staples now is consolidating nicely near all-time highs. So all of these sectors, I would think, are gearing up for a breakout and perhaps lead the way to new high in the next part of the rally. So those are a handful of sectors that are certainly set up better. You've got losers, certainly, like the small caps in the broader market that got hit really by the breadth deterioration of late. And if we do get another short-term pullback, those areas are likely to see new lows, maybe in financials, even as some of those winners that I mentioned might just see abbreviated pullbacks to some areas of support and produce a nice entry point.
Well, Dana, one feature that we do each time you come on is we also talk about a few winners and losers just as far as countries that you follow with different ETFs. So are there any countries you're seeing that may present an opportunity for investors, and any that you'd avoid?
Sure. I would say from the opportunity standpoint, some of the countries that we've actually been in for a couple of years now that continue to perform well, I would say Taiwan and Vietnam looking very good. Still, like I mentioned, looking at those winners, you want to see sectors and areas of the market that have held up well, even during short-term turbulence, like those two countries have. Another one that is on our radar right now would be Switzerland for whatever reason. So the ticker for the ETF would be EWL. It's just held up nicely. It's held up well during this turbulence, whereas much of core Europe has gotten hit a little bit worse. Switzerland has been hanging up right near all-time highs, pretty much holding up near those that line in the sand, and should be geared up for a breakout and a new new up leg there into all-time highs. So that's just a handful of countries that are still on our radar. Still, we want to be long, and we want to be buying little short-term pullbacks.
So, Dan, I also have to ask you about the resource sector, especially the precious metals. We didn't discuss this pre-recording, but look, the pressure has continued to be on GDX, GDXJ, those gold miner ETFs. Gold has been relatively flat, but more relatively flat under that $1,800 level. What's your outlook for the precious metals stocks? Are you buying? Are you selling? Are you kind of neutral, just on the sidelines?
We're mostly neutral. They're still in, you know, this consolidation phase. I think the odds are they still eventually break out and put in that next leg up in that major bull market. But still, you know, consolidating the run-up that they had into the summer of last year, I think. So right now, there's plenty of resistance to get through, plenty of, you know, technical challenges ahead. That for us, they're still trading instruments. You know, you can buy the bottom of the range, sell the top of the range, but nothing to get too aggressive about right now. And until we clear some of those technical hurdles, we would still be, like I said, accumulating into weakness at the bottom of the range. And certainly they're not buying holds right now. So you got to take some profits when you get a nice bounce.
All right, before I get you out of here, Dana, there's one topic that keeps on coming up in our interviews for people saying, well, this is what I'm watching for next year. And the answer we keep hearing is all about politics. Everyone says, well, there's the midterms in the U.S. and political tensions are high in this country and that country. I know that you don't invest around politics, but what are your thoughts when you hear people, commentators saying these are the key catalysts, political catalysts to watch for next year?
Yeah, from an investment standpoint, anytime you let politics kind of into your decision making, it's a major, it can be a major red flag or a major obstacle to profit. So we, as you know, we like to stick to a quantitative objective strategy and system that takes all of its input from market data itself. So all the exogenous stuff, political, geopolitical stuff, has no bearing on what we do. I will say, to the extent that any of those events or potential events do have a bearing, do have an impact on the markets, you can rest assured that that will be filtered in through the markets. It will be filtered in have an impact on the market data itself. So you don't have to speculate on what's going to happen and the market's kind of reaction to that. All you have to do is look at the data. Anything that has an impact or has some sort of bearing on what the market's going to do, it's going to be filtered through the data. So that's our advice. Ignore the noise and the headlines. Just concentrate on the data, and that will steer you in the right direction.
All right, Dana, always great chatting with you. Thank you, as always, for taking time throughout this year to share what your models are telling you. Again, you have been, for the most part, spot on throughout this year in pretty much every sector we've talked about. So it's a pleasure having you on the show. Again, I thank you for taking time with us. I hope you have a great holiday season. We'll be chatting again, maybe by the end of this year, but for sure in the new year. Thank you, Dana, for all of the time you spent with us this year.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure, Tori, and happy holidays, Jeff.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that first segment with Dana Lyons, where we really just looked big picture at the markets and even got his comments on precious metals. In this segment, we are switching our focus to the precious metals sector as we are chatting with Dave Erfle, founder and editor of the Junior Miner Junkie. And Dave, usually we chat on Tuesday every week, but when we chatted this Tuesday, we didn't even bother recording anything because, quite frankly, the sector is back to being very boring. We said we would reconnect on Friday, and if there was something to talk about, then great, we'd record something. As it turns out, there was some pretty big news that broke about mid this week. The M&A continues, and this is a big M&A transaction where Kinross stepped up and made an offer to Great Bear Resources. The total offer, $1.8 billion Canadian. It's about 75% cash, also a share component. There is another additional kicker where if Kinross, I believe, gets into production and issues an over 8.5 million ounce resource, then the shareholders would get even more Kinross shares. That's a long way down the road when we consider that Great Bear still doesn't even have a resource out. It is in the works, but now with this acquisition, who knows when it'll actually be released. Dave, give us your thoughts on this transaction, one of the biggest ones and definitely the biggest coming from a junior getting bought.
Yeah, it's just another acquisition in the sector that we've seen take place recently after the Agnico Kirkland deal was announced. M&A has really started to heat up. And yeah, this is great for the sector and anybody who's a Great Bear shareholder, because this is a huge premium and the stock was already at an all-time high. So, you know, everybody that was a Great Bear shareholder made money, which you can't really say about some of these transactions that have taken place recently, because they're so depressed. The miners and central banks right now are seeing an opportunity. Central banks have ramped up their buying because the gold price is so cheap in relation to the inflation that continues to skyrocket. And the miners, who basically learned their lesson from the last bull market, they were buying juniors at the top of a market by diluting shareholders, and they were also not only were they doing that at the top of a market, but they were buying low margin projects just to get ounces on the books. Well, they're doing the opposite this time. They're buying high margin projects at a time when the sector is out of favor. So this is just more good news for people who are holding juniors that management is de-risking high margin projects.
Well, Dave, just in full disclosure, I am a shareholder of Great Bear, so I am pretty excited about this merger. But what I like about this one compared to the string of other ones we've seen, and I got to give you credit, you called it with the Kirkland Lake Agnico that it would kick off a string of them. And we saw Calibre Fiore, you know, get together. We saw Newcrest and Pretium. We saw Hochschild just do a takeover recently. We saw Golden Star Resources taken over by a Chinese firm. We have seen a string of M&A deals, but this is the first one that reminds me of Kaminak, where it was a junior explorer building a big resource. And when it got taken over, it was one that was widely followed. And if people remember back then when Goldcorp took over Kaminak, it got the money circulating in the space, speculating on who would be next. It started, you know, area play action, and it just got a little bit more enthusiasm in the sector. Are you looking at it in a similar way that we actually may get the animal spirits going again here?
Yeah, well, we've been waiting for that ever since the Kirkland Agnico deal was announced. You know, the tax loss selling is really hitting the stocks hard right now. And but if you take a look at some of the juniors that are de-risking higher margin projects that are close to either the finance stage or a feasibility stage, there's one that I mentioned last week, Bluestone Resources, that it appears like it may be in play also, because it's been bifurcating from the sector as it's gone towards strong resistance at $2, which is close to its all-time high. So, you know, that's just one stock, but there are many others here that are being sold because they're down on the year. And this is the time of year where investors do not care about fundamentals. If they're down on a stock, they don't care about where the gold price is going because their portfolio is doing so well as the stock market is trading back up at all-time highs, near all-time highs again. So everything that they're showing a loss on is being sold with total disregard to any fundamentals whatsoever, which is, you know, a great opportunity. You know, I've been saying that for a while now. The opportunities get better and better as the stocks keep going lower and lower in a lot of these things. But if you have the patience to wait it out and you buy these things with cash and not on margin and just kind of file them away and wait for the gold price to finally catch up with this crazy inflation that's going on here, then you're going to be doing pretty well here in about 6 to 12 months.
Well, Dave, just following up on that comment about how depressed the share prices are, couldn't that be exactly why we're seeing a lot of the M&A in the sector over the last few months?
Absolutely.
Because we're not the only ones that want a deal. The companies that are taking over these companies want a deal.
That's right. The majors are taking advantage of it. Central banks are taking advantage of it by buying gold. I think Singapore announced they were buying gold for the first time since 2000, when the gold price was around $300 an ounce. The Irish Central Bank announced they're buying gold for the first time in 12 years because of inflation. If you take a look at the ETF holdings, gold was bought in November for the first time in a few months. So, you know, retail is buying on this weakness. Central banks are buying on this weakness. Miners are buying ounces in the ground on this weakness. So, you know, it only makes sense that we should be buying on this weakness as well. But you have to have a strong stomach when you're trying to bottom fish and also have a lot of patience for it to finally pay off down the road.
Dave, circling back to that acquisition of Great Bear, do you see any potential of a bidding war coming into the space?
The last bidding war we saw was for Cardinal Resources in Ghana last year, and that was during a bull phase of the market. So I don't see a bidding war here. I would love for it to happen because it would be not only great for Great Bear shareholders, but it would be great for the sector. It would bring more attention to it. But in this environment, I don't see it.
Well, Dave, some people had speculated that Barrick buying up land on both sides of Great Bear may be making a move on it, and others had mentioned Evolution Mining having the nearby Red Lake gold mine may want to take a stab at it, and that maybe some other Aussie producers would want to invade Canada like they were doing a few years ago and make some creative acquisitions. So we'll wait and see. But just on this M&A topic, we've also seen a lot of acquisitions that aren't necessarily takeovers or mergers, but you know, we saw i80 Gold in Nevada make some acquisitions from Barrick to bring some new projects in their fold. Just this week, we saw Dolly Varden and Fury seal a deal where Dolly Varden bought the Homestake project from Fury. And we're seeing a lot of those kind of deals, too, where companies are going out and buying a mine or buying a land position. So are you encouraged by just the level of activity that we're seeing in the space where companies are making a move on ounces?
Yes, absolutely. You know, this needs to happen. You know, it's been talked about for the past few years that this sector needs to consolidate. You know, there's just too many juniors out there, and there's just not enough buyers. So, you know, especially as far as the size of these majors are concerned, you know, that's why it was great to see the Agnico Kirkland deal that creates the third largest major. Because, you know, these majors, they're trying to attract generalist investors. So in order to do that, they need to get bigger and pay healthy dividends. And that's what they've been doing. And, you know, they've also made their balance sheets a lot healthier. They've paid off most of their debt. You know, they're making gobs of money here, even if the gold price does go down to $1,600, all in cost of production did rise this quarter, of course, because of all the inflation. I think it's up to $1,130 now an ounce is the average all in cost of production price. But still, you know, at a gold price of 1780 here, you know, they're doing very well, but they do need to replace those ounces. They know it. And I think this M&A is going to continue, and it's only a matter of time until generalist investors finally wake up to the fact that, hey, these juniors that are de-risking these high margin projects, they're takeover targets, and look how cheap they are in relation to the gold price.
Yeah, let's just get a few more of these takeovers going. But that Great Bear news, I do think very encouraging for the sector. Dave, you mentioned that you're seeing everybody buying on weakness. And you are saying, too, that these exploration plays, they are severely undervalued to the general gold price, to the overall market. We are also seeing higher inflation numbers. Just today, as we're recording this on Friday, we have 6.8% inflation. But gold still is stuck under 1800. And you look at GDX today, GDX is flat. Same with GDXJ. If there is so much buying, or if there is a lot of people looking at this sector saying stuff is cheap, why is the sector not sustaining any uptrend?
Yeah, three words, Corey: tax loss selling. I mean, if you take a look at the GDX, the GDXJ, they became overbought in mid-November when the gold price got above 1850, and then they became oversold when it morphed into yet another fake out. They became oversold in just 2 weeks, starting on December 1st is when tax loss selling really ramped up. And if you take a look at the bounce that we just had this week in both that started on last Friday in the GDX and GDXJ, it was a weak bounce up to the downtrend line from that resistance line at 35 in the GDX and 48, 49 in the GDXJ, and they continue to sell off. But there is some hope for the sector to turn around soon, because if you take a look at the GDXJ, for example, notice on the steep declines in the GDXJ ever since the August 2020 high, the relative strength index, the RSI, has made lower lows with the decline in the GDXJ up until August of this year. So since August of this year, not only in the GDXJ, but in a lot of other stocks I follow, the prices have made lows at that low or even lower lows, but the RSI is not following them to make lower lows as well. So this is a sign that this is a divergence, which may be signaling a bottom forming in not only the GDXJ, but a lot of other companies that I'm following and some that I purchased that have been shellacked for like 50 to 70% after making those huge moves in such a short amount of time last year. So I really think we're close to turning it around, but it remains to be seen. I think this Fed meeting next Wednesday is going to be the biggest meeting of the year, because you know the Fed all of a sudden came out. Powell came out during that congressional testimony and flip-flopped and said, hey, inflation's not transitory anymore. The CPI coming out today at 6.8%, highest since 1982, he front ran that by saying, hey, okay, it's not transitory. It's here, and it's going to be here a while. We're going to have to do something about it, which is the reason why gold is stagnant, which is the reason why gold shares aren't reacting, because now everybody's expecting that the Fed to not only taper, but to move up the taper and start raising rates sooner rather than later. So, you know, all this is gonna come to a head next Wednesday. So we'll see what the market does in reaction to this. In the meantime, you see the gold price, it's crammed into that symmetrical triangle that has been created for the past nearly 17 months now, and it's about to make a strong move in either direction. If you take a look at the gold shares and silver showing relative weakness to the gold price, they're warning that direction is going to be lower. So it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen next Wednesday, because FOMC meeting and their decision about the dot plot and what they're going to do about tapering interest rates and all that is out of the way, toward the end of the week, that's when big money traders and fund managers take their vacations, you know, for the holiday vacations. So I think tax loss selling pressure will ease on the gold stocks at that time. And we should at least see a bounce into next year. But what is going to happen after that bounce remains to be seen.
Yeah, and where that bounce takes us, because unfortunately, even this most recent bounce really didn't take out any key resistance levels. And that's been one of the issues, too, is that the bounces we have had have been relatively short-lived and fairly weak when you look back over this year and a half correction. Dave, thank you, as always, for your time. Chat again next week. Everybody, stick around. We're going to be right back with Sean Broderick.
Thank you, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to switch directions just a little bit in this segment, maybe even the next segment, as we are now chatting with Sean Broderick. He is a natural resource analyst over at Weiss Ratings. And Sean, we talked to you about a wide range of markets, and that's what we're going to be doing here. Before we get into some of the individual sectors that you like, I do just want a quick little comment from you regarding the U.S. equity markets, because U.S. markets have been more volatile recently, but it still seems very prevalent that we have this buy the dip mentality still within these markets, because it was the Thanksgiving Friday news event of the COVID variant that through the markets kind of off foot and got people a bit more fearful of more lockdowns. But now, as we've turned really the month and as we're looking to the end of this year, we're seeing, at least at the start of the week, a good start for U.S. equity markets. Sean, what's your takeaway from this volatility that we're seeing in the U.S. markets, but it's still seemingly biased to the upside?
Right. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say we are going to have a Santa Claus rally. And one thing that actually makes that possible is the recent shakeout we had, because many things were kind of puffed up anyway. So they got knocked down to more reasonable levels, like the oil and gas stock that I just recommended to my gold and silver trader subscribers, as a matter of fact. I mean, that's down maybe 15% from where we sold it. So it's a good time to buy it, you know, if like you believe in the big trend. But what happened was it has become obvious that A, the Fed is going to increase the taper. So it's going to taper faster, which means take away some of the free money that it's been pumping into the markets. And also, we are going to have two rate hikes next year. And the market had a hissy fit about that. That's basically what we've been seeing, is the market throwing a tantrum saying, we hate that, we want our free money, stop taking away the punch bowl and all this stuff. So that was going on. And then we had Omicron, you know, so those two things together really worked together to knock things down. Now it turns out that the Omicron variant, while it's more contagious, is not as deadly as the Delta variant and as previous variants. Well, that's great news. And in fact, I'm not sure if it was your show where I was speaking about it, or it might have been another show. That's what happened to the 1918 flu. Was that eventually it evolved into a version that's very contagious, but not deadly. And I'm not saying that a virus has a mind, but from a virus survival viewpoint, that's a smart way to go, because you want everybody to catch the virus if you're a virus, but you don't want to kill your host. So eventually that's what we're probably going to see happen with COVID. It's going to evolve down to something that we take shots for every year, and some people die, not a lot, and we just learn to live with it. So anyway, the market realized that Omicron wasn't as bad, so that really turned things around. And at the same time, China, which had been squeezing financial conditions in its country because it was kind of worried about a real estate bubble, decided it had squeezed too much, and so they started unsqueezing. For if you're in the commodity space, that's extremely bullish news. So we have the turnaround on COVID, We also have the turnaround on China. That's a 1-2 that's been very good for our portfolios and probably for most of your listeners as well.
Yeah, Sean, it's nice to see that at least some of the fears around the Omicron variant are easing up a little bit. But back to the Fed policy, you write on inflation a lot, Sean, and I read a lot of your pieces. And I know that longer term, when people are creating this much money supply, it leads to inflation. But there's a lot of people that are looking at the rate of change as being the key driver. So do you think if we possibly have peaked with that 6.2% hot CPI reading from October, and we see that taper down some to 5% inflation, 4% inflation moving into next year, do you think that will change the Fed's policy, or do you think they're going to have to speed up their tapering and get hiking to fight inflation? Where do your thoughts lie now based on where we're at?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Chad, because I have a chart that I'm sending out to subscribers on my wealth-wave.com website on Thursday, which is about what Wall Street is expecting from inflation. And they expect, we have seen peak inflation right now, and they believe inflation is going to go down in January. I do not hew to that view. I believe that we are going to see inflation continue to ramp up. I don't think we're going into runaway inflation, but I think we're going to see, at least through the middle of next year, stronger inflation, just because of all the forces that have built up in the system. There's inflation that has yet to be passed along, right? And so suppliers, they can actually say, well, we'll just eat the price hikes and not pass it along to our customers. Or in a hot market where people are buying pretty much everything, which is what we have now, they can gradually add that inflation in and hope people don't squeeze too much. And so that's kind of what we're seeing happening. So I don't think we've seen peak inflation. Is that going to force the Fed's hand? Well, they are planning in 2 interest rate hikes next year. Wouldn't be too much of a surprise if we went to 3. However, I don't think it's doom and gloom. It's just that, you know, we were in a pandemic environment for a long time. No one was buying anything. Now that the global economy is coming back, it's actually kind of good news in a way. I know everybody hates to pay higher prices. I do too. But it's a sign of economic activity. So I think the Fed has a lot to do with what happens in this market. There's so much, quote unquote, free money sloshing around, right? That's what drives up asset prices. That's been helping you and me is like we watch our positions go higher. Well, it's because the banks have nothing else to do with all this free cash. So they pour it into the stock market. And now that they think that the Fed's going to tighten up, they're not buying things so much. So that's kind of a problem. So I see that lasting into the early part of next year, maybe to the middle of next year. We are looking at the highest inflation since 1982. I think it can get higher. It won't be a straight line. There will be a dip in the inflation rate, and that's when everybody will say, okay, inflation's over, that's done. But they have to remember nothing travels in a straight line. It'll zigzag like it always does. So just get ready for more volatility on the inflation front. But for a point of good news to counter that, because now I've already talked about COVID, and I think I always say when I'm on your show, you know, there could be another COVID variant coming. I have to say that, and people say, shut up. But, you know, there probably can be another COVID variant coming. But some bullish news is that insiders are buying. I have a chart that I sent out to my gold and silver trader subscribers today, which was great, which shows insider buying, insider selling. Now, normally, insiders sell more than they buy, simply because that's one of the ways that they compensate insiders is they give them stock. So they have to sell it. But insider selling has crashed and insider buying is picking up. And so what does that tell us? That tells us that insiders believe that their share prices are going higher, probably within the next 6 months. This is one of the reasons why I think we're going to have a Santa Claus rally, is because if the insiders are buying, they know things that the rest of us probably don't. And so that's kind of bullish too. So overall, I tend to be bullish on the market. I know that's a long roundabout way to answer your question, but you know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of balls up in the air that I'm juggling here.
So Sean, one final point on inflation here. You see inflation getting even a little bit hotter from this level. What markets are you looking at that are telling you this is going to happen? Because the argument being markets are forward looking, and look, we had a lot of markets move much higher. A lot of inflation type of markets too move much higher through a lot of last year and into the start of this year, but then they topped a little bit before, right? Potentially inflation topped. what market do you think is going to show us that inflation is coming before we start to see that data?
There are three things that I'm actually watching on that. One is energy prices, which really, I mean, corrected hard and fast when the Omicron fear came out. Now we're seeing energy prices pick up again. Talk about resilience. The resilience in the energy space, I expect we'll see higher oil prices next year, simply because of the whole supply-demand thing. And I don't think the global economy is shutting down. And a lot of U.S. oil fields either shut down or else didn't have enough money invested in them, that we're probably not going to see oil production in the U.S. pick up nearly as much as some people would like. So that's going to be a real problem. Another thing is import prices, producer import prices, which are published every month. Those point to higher prices coming through. And that's probably one of the main drivers we had. I had a column about this on WealthWave. It was either the last week or the week before, just how the higher prices that the producers are already paying have to work through the system. So that's important as well. And then it's shipping delays. Now, they have done a lot of stuff to get the shipping delays down, and everyone was breathing a sigh of relief. And then the shipping delays started to come up again because people that wanted to ship stuff overseas to the U.S. Said, oh, look, they've like broken the bottleneck. We can send stuff now. So now they're shipping more stuff. So when you put these three things together, there are probably going to be higher prices. That's just the way I look at it. Now, I'm glad to change my mind. I don't want to pay higher prices any more than anyone else. I would love for some news to come along to convince me otherwise. But the way I look at it now, you know, probably in the early part of next year, maybe the middle of next year, we are going to have higher prices and hotter inflation.
So then, Sean, let's get a little bit more granular then with some of the sectors or even individual stocks that you like within some of these sectors. You have brought up energy. Care to elaborate on any certain energy metals and stocks that you like?
Well, I won't tell you the one I recommended this week, but I'll tell you the one I recommended last week, which was Chevron. I mean, man, did that go on sale. It's a fantastic oil company. Yeah, it's a big one. And so maybe many of your listeners only want small ones. Well, let me get to my portfolios. Oh, I just clicked on the marijuana portfolio. And funny thing is, I added Planet 13 when it fell down a hole like 3 weeks ago. And I said, no way is that possible. And it got worse because of Omicron, right? Because Planet 13, I don't know if any of... I should say, I don't know if most of your listeners know this, but the thing about Planet 13 is it grows marijuana, yes, but what it's really known for is its big superstores, where it sells not only its brands, but also all the other brands it can get in, like, Nevada. It's also in California. It's also branching out across the country. You've got licenses for Chicago and stuff like that. So it's kind of emblematic of, like, what could happen in the cannabis space. That's one reason I watch it, because cannabis multi-state operators, they have like one business model. Planet 13 is a little different, and it's a bit more edgy. And it's up like 6% at the time you and I talk. Now, this recording won't play on the same day as you and I talk, but that's an indication that the cannabis sector is about to turn around, or at least that's how I would look at it. So I think people should keep that kind of thing in mind. When you look at what else is going on, I mean, I like stuff like Cleveland Cliffs, which is iron, right? But it's also steel. They also bought a steel company. What was weighing on the industrial metals industry for so long was what was going on in China. People saw China pulling back, you know, starting to make money tighter, starting to really lean on like all the stuff going on there, all the activity. Well, China seems to be going the other way. That should light a fire under not only Cleveland Cliffs, but many of the better industrial metal stocks could do very, very well for you. And that's something you should keep in mind. One that's been performing well for us, and I hate to keep jumping industries, but you know, we have triple digit percentage gains on this one, and I expect we'll have much more, is Lithium Americas Corporation. Now, there are There's a whole bunch of good lithium stocks. There are also some that are stinkers. People should be very careful or else they should just buy LIT, which is the ETF that holds the best stocks in the industry anyway. But Lithium Americas is doing all the right thing, and we just added one another week, which is really not mentioned right now because it's a little underwater still. But I'll talk about it another time when we talk. But this one has a new mine coming on in the middle of next year. And so that one is up strongly today. It's not quite back to where we entered, but I expect it will be soon. So lithium is an area where you can see plenty of good things on. Meanwhile, you know, so many energy stocks, oil and gas stocks, look for these stocks that are breaking their downtrends right now. That's what I would recommend to anyone right now. I mean, not the ones that are going sideways, and especially not the ones that are really burdened with debt. Because in a rising interest rate environment, this is something we all have to keep in mind, right? If interest rates are going up, companies that have to refinance their debt are going to have to pay higher interest rates. Now, most companies have some kind of debt. Some don't, but most do. And some debt's okay. But those companies that are burdened by debt, higher interest rates could be a make or break situation for those companies. So be very careful about what you buy going forward. Don't buy companies with too much debt. That could be a real problem next year if interest rates go higher, as we think they're going to do.
Well, Sean, you really covered a lot of ground there on the commodity sector and the energy sector, and great point there about some of the oil and gas companies being kind of debt-laden, and so as interest rates shift, that could be a growing concern for some of those companies. One other area of the energy space besides oil and gas and lithium that we should probably mention is the uranium sector. I know you write about that. I know you follow the sector. It's had an amazing run this year. It's been one of the breakout commodities in 2021. It actually started running in 2020. Some of that's based on that physical supply situation, and some of it's just hot money. But it's had a nice correction now. There's a lot of the stocks are down 20, 30, even 40% from where they were trading just in September and October. What do you make of the uranium market setup, particularly the uranium miners?
That was a buying opportunity, and it's one I used. I hope nobody sold during that recent pullback. I can understand completely if you got disgusted and you threw up your hands and said, screw it. I'm going to go buy a bank. You know, somebody I know is going to make money in a rising interest rate environment. And I would understand that. But the big picture in uranium is so tight and so bullish longer term that I think you have to have at least something in this industry. My uranium stocks are doing very, very well today. And again, it'll be a zigzag thing. Now, uranium is off highs it hit just a couple months ago. That's a shame. And I think that took some of the wind out of the sector. But don't you worry, it's coming back. Of course, you know, as we have more and more of these funds, and it seems like a new one is created every other month, to buy physical uranium, that's going to soak up the excess supply on the market. And it's going to get to a drum-tight situation. And then it's going to be the thing where it's empty. And then what are you going to do? Then you're going to see prices take off. So uranium is one of the things I'm most bullish on. It's just to really confound my critics, I have no idea when it's going to happen. But I wouldn't miss out this coming move in uranium for the world. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Sean, one other point that I wouldn't mind chatting with you about is also base metals. Because you have alluded to some of them there. But look, copper, a great example, has just gone sideways in a choppy manner here. And the copper stocks have largely lagged that copper move, that strong copper move from the COVID washout. Are you seeing opportunity here, at least in the short term?
Well, I own copper stocks already. I'm not actually looking to buy more right now, if like that's any kind of an answer for you. And sure, we have seen the price of copper move sideways. A lot of it has to do with China, and I hate to keep coming back to that, but people were really worried that China was going to crack down on all sorts of things. And so copper kind of, and because copper miners are leveraged to the underlying metal, they really got caught in that, you know? And so it was kind of a grind for many of them, and that's no fun. But on the other hand, at least now, China looks like it's going back to a more easy money policy. If they just announced lower reserve requirements for the banks, which they did, and they're still trying to stimulate the economy, the next thing they'll probably do, or at least one of the next things, will be more public works projects. What is that? That's very good for copper. It always is. And so, you know, I can understand why people would be disappointed. We're well off those October highs. And many people looked at the high in October and the high we had back in May and say, aha, that's a double top in copper. Yeah, but just look at the supply-demand situation. It's extremely rare that we see new copper mines built. The older ones are really using up the high-grade stuff. What's going to be left? You know, there's a big supply-demand squeeze. We can't go through the rest of the 21st century without either more copper or else used in much better ways. So that's a situation and a story that looks incredibly bullish to me.
Well, Sean, just one more area that we should touch on. If we're discussing commodities, we're talking about China, we're talking about energy, are some of the strategic metals, in specific, the rare earth elements. I've started to notice on a lot of chat forums, more discussion about it, more discussion about supply chains, getting rare earths out of China and into North America or Australia. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on the rare earth sector before we wrap up?
Well, I mean, if anyone likes the rare earths, and God knows I wrote a report about it earlier this year, I like them. REMX, which is the VanEck Vectors Rare Earth Strategic Metals ETF. God, that's a mouthful. Really, they have to reconsider that one. Anyway, during this latest sell-off, the thing pulled back to its 50-day moving average. That's a buying opportunity. If you want to be in rare earths, you know, you should be either buying REMX or else buying the leading companies in that fund that are available to buy in whatever country you're in. Some of the stocks it owns, we in the U.S. can't buy easily, which is one of the nice things about that fund. But some we can. And so, you know, keep that in mind. I like some Australian companies. I think there's strong potential there. Again, as we move toward the future, we're going to be using more lithium, which we've already talked about. We're going to be using more rare earths. That's what the new technology takes. So we had kind of a break, though REMX just hit a new high in, what, November, I think? So, you know, that one hasn't been on that much of a break, but it did pull back to its 50-day moving average. So if you're looking for a buying opportunity, I think that's probably as close as you'll get. You could wait for it to pull back to its uptrend, which is a little lower, but, you know, and eventually it will go to its uptrend. The question is when. So I like rare earths. I like select companies in rare earths. Some have actually treated me badly this year, and shame on them. But some have done pretty well. So, you know, I'll still keep playing the rare earth space. It's not as easy to play rare earths as it is some other metals. Have to keep that in mind, too. That's why buying an ETF is actually not a bad thing to do for something like this, because sometimes it gets really tough. But I think that's a good space to be in as well.
Sean, I love that comment. Shame on you, stock, for going down. That's the way that I think all investors should look at it. Because you know what? You're out there trying to pick out these stocks that you think have some upside in them. And for resource investors, man, oh man, you need to be selective this year in terms of the sectors that you are in and those stocks. Because even in an environment where we saw at least a handful of sectors, resource sectors move higher, sometimes those stocks did lag as well. Sean, as always, man, thank you for your time. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. I hope you all enjoyed the show as well as all our daily editorials that we recorded throughout the week. Please be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, and listen to all those editorials and let us know what you think, especially of the companies that we interviewed this week. Sean, everybody, hope you all have a great rest of your week.
Thanks very much.